You drink coffee, I drink coffee, just about everyone drinks coffee. So why bother with anything but the best? Darren's coffee is roasted at his new shop in Claremont, Indiana. And coming soon, you can order on Amazon and support the show by using Scott Horton's affiliate link. Darren'sCoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
All right, y'all. Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Check out the big fundraiser. Still going on. End of the year fundraiser. Write it off on your taxes. It's not too late. LibertarianInstitute.org/support. And, of course, you can find the archives of this show at LibertarianInstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. Okay. So now introducing our good friend, Gareth Porter. So good of a friend that he's willing to do an interview 2 days after Christmas when people are trying to take it easy. Behind the real U.S. strategic blunder in Syria. Gareth's latest for MiddleEastEye.net. Welcome back to the show, my friend. How are you?
Thanks very much, Scott. I'm good. Glad to be back again.
Well, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and all that stuff for you, too. Let's not do the in a nutshell. Let's go ahead and go through this from the beginning. So, 2010, Chelsea Manning heroically leaks the WikiLeaks to Assange. Assange starts publishing them, and they have all this stuff about the American sock puppet dictator of Tunisia in them, and everybody already hated him anyway, and they already had massive food riots breaking out because of price inflation, and that was the beginning of the end of him. And then, blam, the people of Egypt said, wow, you can do that? And then, so they went to overthrow their dictator, too, and the Arab Spring broke out. So part of what was going on right around that same time was a day of rage, or a few of them, started in Syria. And so even though the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt had been against American sock puppet dictators, the revolution just beginning to break out in Syria was against a dictator who had, I don't know how you want to characterize it. It seems like he had been mostly compliant, torturing people for George W. Bush, that kind of thing. He was no kept sock puppet like Hosni Mubarak, but he was, not causing trouble for the USA anyway, I don't think. But anyway, America and I guess as you write here, its allies decided we got to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. So is that basically, sound like a pretty sound lead up? Sorry to use sound twice in a row there to how your story begins here with American intervention in 2011.
Yeah, I mean, I would frame it somewhat differently in the sense that the Assad regime had a very complicated relationship with the United States. Going back to the Iraq War, of course, Assad was certainly allowing people to cross the border from Syria into Iraq to fight against the Americans. And this was definitely held against him at that point. And at the same time, we know that Assad was, had a close strategic alliance with Iran. I mean, the Iranians regarded, and this, of course, is central to the peace that we're discussing here, because the Iranians viewed the Assad regime as an absolutely crucial piece of their security policy, in the sense that that it was the presence of a friendly regime in Syria that allowed them to resupply Hezbollah with rockets and missiles, which were, on one hand, Hezbollah's defense against the Israelis, and at the same time, and more importantly from the Iranian point of view, the Hezbollah arsenal was the really most important part still in 2011, still the most important part of its deterrent to an Israeli attack. So that's really a part of the frame historically and geopolitically for what happened in 2011 after the outbreak of the protest against the Assad regime in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then, we pretty much saw how in Libya they decided, well, we're going to co-opt this one. And in Yemen, we're going to co-opt that one or try. In Bahrain, we're going to crush this one because we're not putting up with nothing from the majority Shia population of Bahrain. That's our base, and they can go to hell. And so you can pretty much see the American slash Saudi reaction to the Arab Spring as it plays out. Where it's convenient for us, we'll take advantage of it. And where it's not, then they'll lay down and die.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, in the case of Bahrain, just to add a slight or more than a slight amendment, I mean, initially, at least, the Obama administration was very concerned about human rights violations in Bahrain. And it was only really after the Saudis stepped in and threatened the United States with a reconsideration of the alliance, meaning reconsideration of access to the naval facilities in Bahrain, that suddenly Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, did an about-face and said, well, you know, we don't have to have a consistent policy in every state and every circumstance. So that they suddenly changed their mind and said, we can live with what the Bahrainis and their Saudi protectors are doing mm-hmm. against the Shia.
All right. So now to zoom back into Syria again, as you say, and I guess this is the real problem that Israel has with Iran more than anything else. We know it ain't their illicit nuclear weapons program that never existed. Thanks a lot, David Sanger. It must be something else. It's the fact that Iran backs up Hezbollah, and Hezbollah has the power to keep Israel out of southern Lebanon, or at least, you know, the more Iran helps them, the easier it is for them to keep the Israelis from reinvading that place, which, you know, I guess they are wont to do from time to time anyway.
No question that Hezbollah is a thorn in Israel's side. They want to get the Israelis have wanted to get rid of them very badly for a long, long time. But of course, again, Hezbollah has to do essentially with the strategic relationship between Israel and Iran as well, because without Hezbollah, Israel can threaten Iran, and if necessary, they can carry out the threat. So that's why there's a very there's a two-way relationship between those two issues.
In other words, so yeah, they're not just worried about what Hezbollah will do if they attack Lebanon, but if they attack Iran, Hezbollah is sort of an Iranian auxiliary on their flank at that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Iranians can threaten Israel retaliation very effectively through Hezbollah, without question. Mm.
All right. So, yeah, we have a confluence of interests coming together here in 2011. One thing, though, I was talking to various reporter types that I talked to on this show at the time, people like Patrick Coburn and others, who said that, you know, this isn't going to be easy, and especially once it was pretty clear that Obama was not going to launch a NATO air war, as he did in Libya. After all, in Libya had the fig leaf of a UN resolution. He could have gone Bill Clinton Kosovo style in Syria, I guess, but he didn't, as far as full air power goes. So there were a lot of people, even very early on, Eric Margulies, I think, was another. If people go back and check the archives, early in 2011, who said, hey, there's a lot of consensus for the Assad regime in Syria. You know, people should not underestimate his staying power here, especially considering what's at stake. Because if the Alawites lose power, they lose everything, and maybe their lives. And that goes for the Druze and the different kinds of Christians and Shiites, too, when their enemies are a bunch of head-chopping suicide bomber types.
Right. And so I think what this is leading to in terms of this article is the necessary conclusion that you have a president, President Obama, who was extremely skeptical about getting involved in war, another war in the Middle East, especially in an Arab country and especially in Syria. And he clearly was not in favor of the United States becoming directly and actively involved in this, at least on the surface. But at the same time, what my story published today, it's really a column, and it's written as a column, not a news piece. What it shows is that where the power really lies in terms of U.S. national security policy, once again, as is so often the case, is not the president himself. It's a set of powerful interests that have to do with the war-making capability and interventionary capability, that is the CIA and particularly the Pentagon and, and its auxiliaries, and their relationship with the three Sunni states, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, who had decided in September 2011 that they were going to overthrow the Assad regime using an army that they were going to put together an arm. Mm-hmm. And so it's that set of relationships. It's where the power really flowed that is so striking and so important about this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the Israelis? Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador, made it very clear to the Jerusalem Post, as he put it, Israel has wanted Assad gone from the beginning of this thing.
Yeah, of course, there's a confluence of interest there. I agree. In this happened. I mean, actually, Israel was a little bit late to the party. My research shows, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but the earliest indication from the Israelis that they believed that it was time to get rid of Assad was April 2012, a few months after the trio of Sunni states had made the decision that they were going to do it. And of course, they did it after consultation with the United States and got the United States, got the Obama administration to support it as part of their decision-making process. But the Israelis had not made a decision, as far as I can see, until April 2012. That they were in favor of getting rid of Assad. So I think it's pretty clear here that this is not something that the Israelis orchestrated first with the United States, or, you know, that there was an Israeli-Saudi agreement or something like that. It was, the trio of Sunni states that made the decision among themselves, okay, now's the time, let's do it.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I'd have to go back and look. I mean, I know that Giraldi reported in December of 2011 that there are two new findings, one on Iran and one on Syria, and that they had been signed, I guess, the previous month. And I know that Margulies reported September at the latest, 2011, that the French special forces and spies were there helping organize the opposition there. There's one in the Observer from, I think, I'm pretty sure it would be July, about Bandar sending jihadists. You know, I'm trying to just search my brain for whatever I can try to remember from what we knew from 2011. You know, it'd be worth checking Pepe Escobar's archives too, because, you know, certainly I was interviewing him at that time, and absolutely, you know, Israel's role would have been one of the questions at that time then, and one that I would have been asking him, and one that I think he probably was asking too, because we already know that David Wumser, Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor, always said, you know, if we could expedite the chaotic collapse in Syria, well, that would be great for, you know, leading to our ability to reconstruct a future, you know, situation there that's more amenable to us. And by us, of course, right, he means Likud.
That was the extremist Likud position, you know, before.
Going way back. Yeah. Going back to 1996. Yeah.
Going way back to the 1990s. Right. But there was then a reassessment, obviously, in Israel of the Assad regime during, you know, the period, you know, of the first decade of the 2000. And so they were not at all clear at that point until after the Sunni regimes had made their decision that this is what was in their interest. Mm-hmm. Because remember, in 2009-2010, the Israelis were in process of negotiating with the Assad regime, and the United States was helping to try to arrange those negotiations. Right. Now, you know, they may have been somewhat pessimistic, they may have been skeptical, but nevertheless, they were giving that a try because of the alternatives that they saw, which were not very inviting. In other words, they thought that any alternative to Assad, that is the Israelis, believe that any alternative to Assad would be extremist Islamists, at least of the caliber or of the flavor of the Muslim Brotherhood, but more likely, you know, more conservative, more extremist than the Muslim Brotherhood. So, so they were not at all ready to jump into a war to try to bring about a war against Assad at that point. And it was really, I think they saw what was going on already. I think they knew the United States had already secretly agreed to support through the Petraeus plan, you know, the Petraeus covert operation, the arming of the Sunni opposition forces against Assad. And they said, okay, well, this is the time to support it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no. So let's get back to the Petraeus thing in a minute, because that's the whole, you know, rat line project. And I was just making fun of myself, actually, and him a little bit on Twitter earlier, saying, you know, I always attack Petraeus for escalating and losing two wars, but I always forget to really put the blame on him for to the degree that he deserves it for Libya and Syria, which happened when he was the director of CIA.
And this is very important because, again, I mean, I think what you see here is that the CIA played a huge role. I don't talk about this in detail in my piece, but clearly Petraeus and the CIA were playing a huge role in presenting this plan to the White House and getting them to agree that this is the way to proceed to help the Sunni allies without getting directly involved ourselves. And this was the kind of argument that finally, obviously, Obama went along with. Mm-hmm. Weak-willed as he is. I mean, he was a skeptic about doing this, but he was not ready to stand up to the national security state of his own administration.
Yeah, ever, I think is how you meant to finish
this.
Hardly ever, yeah. So, and now, Hillary Clinton, so this was her last year in power was 2012 then, and as soon as she was done at the beginning of the second term and she was out, the first thing she did was put an article in the New York Times, which clearly came from her. It was no investigative thing. It was, you know, she handed it to them that she, Panetta, and Petraeus had tried and tried and tried to get Obama to do more to back the rebels in Syria, but he would only do so much. Namely, meaning, I think what you're talking about here, coordinating the allies, basically the CIA running the Qatari and Saudi op.
Yeah, and this is part of the larger picture here of Obama really saying no, not just to doing more in terms of the covert operation, but refusing the Sunni proposal, which was originally they wanted to send not just anti-tank missiles to the chosen commanders who they would hand pick in Syria or bring from outside Syria in some cases, but also they wanted actually the United States to supply shoulder fired surface to air missiles to these folks. In other words, they wanted to go from the very beginning all the way to the capability that they've been trying to get the United States to agree to support for, you know, the last 5 years. And of course, during this past year, we know that it has been done. Mm-hmm. Not just anti-tank missiles, but shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles have been supplied to certainly to Ahrar al-Sham, which means in effect to supply al-Qaeda as well.
You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, now, so I'm sorry for skipping around so much here, but I really want to get back into that rat line stuff here in a second, but I want to go back over a couple of things here real quick, because I think it's important for the consensus in Washington, D.C. depends a lot on what the Israelis want, and there's two great sources for Michael Oren really speaking for Netanyahu here, I think. One is the Jerusalem Post, where he says, yeah, we wanted him gone from the beginning. Whether that's exactly right or not, I take your point. But then there's the other thing. All you got to do is type in Oren Sunnis, and it's Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador, and he's at the Aspen Fancy Pants conference, and he's talking with Jeffrey Goldberg, and it's right at the beginning of the clip. It won't take much time. And he explains that, well, there's this in Syria, there's the Sunni evil and the Shia evil, and we prefer the Sunni evil because the Shia evil is backed by Iran, which has military nuclear capability, which, of course, is a lie. And then he blames the entire death count of all sides of the war on Assad as his other, you know, excuse. But this actually took place at the end of June 2014. So just 1 week after Baghdadi had declared himself the caliph and the ruler of the Islamic State. And and still he's saying we still prefer the Sunni evil to the Shia evil. And he directly refers to, hey, don't get me wrong, they just massacred 1,700 Shia Iraqi Air Force cadets out there in the field. So, yeah, he's specifically referring to the Islamic State here and still saying, but we prefer this evil to that one. And then, you know, I think there's also the New York Times story. Where on the front page, the keywords here are hemorrhage to death. We prefer that both sides hemorrhage to death. At that point, it seemed like maybe they were backing off from, yeah, we really ought to get rid of Assad, to, yeah, let's just keep the war going for as long as possible, just to weaken all sides, ultimately, kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think that's really been the primary Israeli point of view.
That seems like Obama's policy too, right?
Well, I was just going to say that I think that became Obama's policy when it was clear that there was going to be a stalemate, you know, that this was not going to be a short war. Originally, you know, let's go back to the beginning here. In September 2011, Obama's advisors were telling him, look, this is going to be a short war. He's not going to last long. It became clear that his advisors had told him wrongly that there was going to be a short war. This was going to become a very bloody, longer conflict. Then it was clear that the Obama White House was saying, okay, we're not going to choose winners. We're just going to keep it going so that neither side can win. And we'll cite our policy as the basis for trying to get a peace negotiated settlement. But this was only done because it turned out that his advisors gave him very, very bad advice. And this is really the crucial point that I'm trying to talk about in this piece, which is that nobody warned Obama that if we get into supplying or helping the Sunni states to supply the opposition forces with arms, this is going to, and if they're successful, if they are on the verge of pushing back and even threatening to defeat the Assad regime, we're going to get an intervention by the Iranians and Hezbollah, and possibly later on by Russia. Mm-hmm. And that's because nobody had the wit to understand the importance of Syria to Iran strategically, which we had just talked about earlier in this conversation. So this is why it was such a strategic blunder on the part of the White House, which was a strategic blunder by the entire U.S. national security state. There was nobody who was smart enough, who was giving advice to Obama on this, to identify the strategic danger that what was going to happen was that there would be a success on the part of the opposition forces sufficient to bring about an Iranian Hezbollah intervention.
Yeah.
That would thus then bring about a stalemate, and there would be a long, bloody sectarian war. And that's why, you know, it's important to understand the origins of what we have seen over the last few years.
So a year ago, when the CIA was helping the terrorists, and I'm skipping all around here, we're going to have to go back a couple of years in a minute. But a year ago, when the CIA was helping the terrorists so much that they were taking the Idlib province and had, if I have my Coburn right, I think it was they had severed the highway between Aleppo and Damascus. And this was the red line for Putin that made him say, that's it, dude. Here, we're going to start bombing your mythical moderate asses right out of here. At that point, were the terrorists getting out ahead of the policy? They were being more successful than Obama wanted them to be, or the CIA wanted them to be more successful than Obama wanted them to be in that way? Or what do you think?
Very good question, Scott. I don't know the answer exactly what the calculus was on the part of the CIA, on the part of the White House, when they clearly went along with this, the TOW missiles being provided. That was clearly a policy that the White House knew about, made no effort to stop, was clearly on board with. And I have to say that it looks very much like the White House wanted to gain some leverage over the Assad regime to bring it to the table on favorable terms. And this, of course, would have been none other than John Kerry, Secretary of State, pushing this the hardest. So I think, you know, my guess is that it was Kerry's influence more than anybody else that induced the White House to go along with this, on the grounds that otherwise we were facing a situation where we're going to look stupid, we're going to look unsuccessful, and everybody's going to attack us.
Right. Now, so when in 2010, when Kofi Annan had come up with his plan and Hillary was, meeting with the Friends of Syria in Qatar, I think they tried, two or three different times in 2000, maybe going back even to late 2011, certainly through 2012. Was that just obfuscation so they could keep the war going? That was just a plan for a regime change one way or the other? Or what happened with all that?
In 2012, nobody seriously believed that there were going to be peace negotiations, I don't think. It simply wasn't a realistic possibility. Now, you know,
I mean, they created a government in exile for some reason. They really thought they were just going to helicopter it in there and it was drop it on top of Damascus and leave.
Well, I mean, I don't know how difficult or how easy they thought it would be at that moment, but certainly, they did not believe that there was going to be a negotiated settlement. I mean, you know, either there was going to be an effort to overthrow, a successful effort to overthrow the regime, and that Assad would have to step down and there would be a huge, you know, disorder in regard to the leadership of the Syrian Arab Republic, or it was going to take longer to bring that about. I don't believe that there's any evidence that there was serious belief that there could be a negotiated settlement at that point.
Yeah. Well, or one that they could foist on the country either. I mean, Hillary herself told CBS News in February of 2012 that, geez, when it comes to the credible kind of opposition that we could support to be a replacement, we don't really see that. We don't really have anybody to replace the current regime with. And she said that because the CBS guy framed it like, why aren't you doing more? So she had to defend the policy and admit the truth that, well, there's really nobody to put in power. And then she correctly invokes Ayman al-Zawahiri and says, well, he likes the revolution there, so I'm not so sure it's a good idea to help it succeed. And then, of course, that's what she continued to do throughout the rest of the year anyway. But she herself explained why not to do so better than anybody.
Yeah, and again, it depends very often. The answer that you get from somebody in that position really does depend on what their political interests are in terms of the answer. I mean, you know, what it looks like. So I think it's a very good point.
Yep. And of course, we know now from the State Department released emails, I think not the WikiLeaks ones. Either way, there's one from Jake Sullivan to her saying, hey, look, boss, AQ is on our side in this one. And that's from a few weeks before. So I think it's February, not January. It's February 2012. And so she's, I guess, pretty obviously, can't really read her mind, but she's pretty obviously thinking of that email and that news story about Ayman al-Zawahiri that he sent her when she invokes that to the CBS reporter, which brings up the other, of course, really important question here. I guess I'd have to go back to look for the very first time the State Department called al-Nusra al-Qaeda, but it was clear that they were, that this was al-Qaeda in Iraq from at least 2012, early 2013 at the latest. And tell me this, do you remember offhand when John McCain went to meet with the Northern Storm Brigade? That was in 2012, right?
I don't remember. I think it might have been 2013. I'm not sure. It's a good question.
Yeah, I have to go back about the whole Elizabeth O'Baggy and all that. I think it was in 12. And then if you Googled, in real time at the time, when I searched Northern Storm Brigade, up came a Time magazine interview with their leader that had taken place prior to John McCain going to meet with them. And their leader says, yeah, I'm a veteran of Iraq War II, where I fought against the Americans under Zarqawi there. So we all knew this all along. That's been the entire kind of outrage is if there's a slower motion train wreck live through the horror of witnessing worse than the march into Iraq War II, it's this arming of the American people's al-Qaeda enemies this whole time in Syria for 5 years running now.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, I'm sure you know very well that the U.S. government did designate Nusra Front as a terrorist organization in December 2013.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe it had been before that even.
But. Well, you would think so. But it wasn't until December 2013. And then in 2014, there was an airstrike against, of course, the Khorasan group.
Right.
And here's I'm
which was just part of Al-Nusra for the audience.
That's right. And so this is something I'm going to write about. What's so interesting, David Ignatius just wrote a column recently in
that's
which,
the CIA's man, one of the CIA's men at the Washington Post, everybody. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, he's a CIA's man, the Pentagon man, et cetera. But he documents the fact that the United States carried out that bombing raid in 2014 against al-Nusra Front and al-Qaeda, the CIA-backed group that was very close to working very closely with al-Nusra Front was very upset. They said, you're ruining it for us. Al-Qaeda will never work with us now because they don't trust us because it's the United States supporting them. And guess what? For the next year and a half, there was no more strikes against al-Qaeda or Nusra Front in Syria until November of this year. And so one has to believe that our strategists in the Obama administration decided, it's more important to have our boys be able to work closely with a Nusra Front and have them get along and cooperate than to be able to carry out strikes, even if there's some reason to believe that, you know, al-Qaeda is doing something nasty with regard to the United States and the West.
Yeah. Well, you know, it'd be worth revisiting the work of David Enders at McClatchy Newspapers during that time, because I was talking with him a lot. And, you know, I had actually first begun interviewing him when he was covering the Iraq War back in 2005. And so, and this is something you and I have talked about over the years. I know you're very familiar with this concept that during Iraq War II, the Sunni insurgency there was broadly tribal-based and former Ba'athist government elite-based. And then they tolerated for a time the jihadis, the Zarqawiites, whether they, you know, really worked with Zarqawi or not. But according to the military and the CIA, for different times with different incentives behind their numbers, would always more or less admit that they were less than 10% of the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq at any given time. And then, of course, it was not Petraeus, but it was the Sunni tribal leaders who really turned on al-Qaeda and had marginalized them almost out of existence relatively, you know, to much smaller scale beginning in 2006 before the surge even started. But anyway, I digress a little bit. The point being that I would ask David Enders circa 2011 and 12 and 13 and such that, hey, man, remember how in Iraq al-Qaeda was the smallest part of the broadly nationalist Sunni-based insurgency there? And he would say, yeah. And I would say, so what about the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria? And he would say, they dominate the field, man. This is their revolution. This is not the broadly Sunni tribal groups and whatever Sunni factions of the Ba'athists who are, after all, dominated by the Alawites in that political party is in Syria, but still this is the inverse of that. This is al-Qaeda in Iraq's war in Syria is what this is. I mean, that was clear from the beginning, really, that, yeah, okay, maybe there are mythical moderates. It's not that they're mythical. It's just that their power is mythical. If anything, they're just the arms procurement branch of Zarqawi's group.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And I think this part of the story of the U.S. role in the war in Syria is the greatest, perhaps you could call it Orwellian lie that the American people have been subjected to so far in this entire conflict. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be dramatized and brought out, just to get the idea out there that on one hand we're told that the United States is supposed to be taking care of terrorism. They're supposed to be pursuing counterterrorism policy in the Middle East, but this shows that it's exactly the opposite. That's exactly the opposite. Mm.
Well, and listen, I'm sorry I didn't even give you a chance to really explain what's, I think, a really important, and I'm not sure if you broke this already or you're breaking it in this column, that you have a new source, a former, apparently very high-level White House official. Is that correct?
Well, of course.
You can't really say? National Security Council, Pentagon, CIA, can you say that?
I can't say that.
But high enough to know? Is it a deputy? Can you tell me that?
No, I can't. I can't.
You're telling me it's somebody that you think knows. Now, I understand from your article pretty much, this person's responses to your questions. But can you tell me what this person's bottom line was for wanting to talk to you in the first place here? What, more or less what it was that they wanted to say?
I can't explain it any more than to say that this is somebody who was a dissenter from the policy in not that it was somebody who was a dove saying, United States should never be involved in any war in the Middle East, or, certainly you wasn't somebody who would support my position or your position. And the person, believed that either the White House should have tried to do more earlier on to support the opposition, or should have done more to try to avoid the war, to end the war. I mean, one of the two. I mean, it was the person believes that there was a tragic, serious strategic error made from the very beginning and continuing. So, this was a person who was not happy with the policy that was pursued.
All right. Now, Gareth, I promised the audience that we get back to David Petraeus here real quick, too. And so I believe it was mid 2011 through late 2012 that he was the head of the CIA. Notice nobody ever picks on him for Benghazi happening on his watch. But this was it was on his watch. And that's not because CIA is in charge of State Department security, is it? It's because the CIA had their own operation going on in Benghazi at the time. What was Petraeus's role in the Libya war and the Syria war in that era, Gareth?
Well, I mean, I have not really delved into that specific question.
I don't mean that night of that attack necessarily, but I mean in Libya and Syria overall, in Hirsch's rat line.
Yeah, in general, I mean, we can say that the head of the CIA was somebody who did not want, obviously, the truth to be told about what was happening in Benghazi. I mean, that was, that's the most important thing, I think, from the point of view of the role that the CIA was playing in Libya at that point. Clearly there was an effort to cover this up, and the CIA, more than anybody else, wanted to make sure that the truth didn't come out. I think this is a large part of the explanation for why, the Republicans, had all those hearings but never began to get at the truth.
Right. Well, now, all right, so I want to make sure before we wrap this up, and I'm sorry for keeping you so long here. You're always very generous with your time. But, oftentimes when I accuse government officials, especially the very worst, most violent and dishonest government officials, of being stupid, I know it sounds like I'm basically letting them off the hook, in a sense. And certainly I get that criticism sometimes that, everything is all an accident. Every horrible thing that they burn to death is just a big, stupid mistake because of how big and stupid they are. When in reality, if me and Pepe Escobar can have all this ironed out by April 2011, what's really going on here, then how can it possibly be that nobody on the National Security Council is saying, these are Zarqawi's guys, Tilting Sunni against Iran is one thing, but doing this is another. No way. Come on. I mean, this is all a premeditated murder plot. This is high treason. This isn't stupid.
Well, it's both. I mean, you know, you can be treasonous and stupid, but you know, treasonous trumps stupid. But so yeah, I mean, I think that's the key point, that these people made decisions because they believed that they were in their interests. They were in their interests as institutions, as organizations. And of course, Petraeus never makes a decision that's not in his personal interest. And they did so at the expense of the interests of both the Syrian people and the American people. And that's really the most important point. I mean, I think that, you know, what they did was stupid, but it was also worse than stupid. It was evil.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Gareth. Well, you're the best, man. Thanks very much for writing all the great stuff you do and for coming on my show.
Thank you for having me, Scott. Always glad to be on.
All right. Happy New Year, man.
Happy New Year to you.
All right, guys, that's the heroic Gareth Porter, the best reporter, MiddleEastEye.net for this one, behind the real U.S. strategic blunder in Syria. Read it and weep. And that's the show. ScottHorton.org for the full archive, 4,300 and something or other interviews for you there, ScottHorton.org. And check out really what's going on is all over at LibertarianInstitute.org/everything, but yeah, Scott Horton Show and support. Write it off on your taxes. It's not too late. And by the way, when you go to libertarian.org/support, you can see there's all kinds of great kickbacks that we have for you, books and silver coins, and you can enter a raffle. Man, I haven't been playing this up. You can enter a raffle for just $50 to win 2 weeks vacation and permaculture course at this awesome compound in the rainforest of Costa Rica. From the great Verde Energia. We did it before, Verde Energia. We did it before, and it's awesome. And you can check all of that out. It's not too late to enter. Just go to libertarianinstitute.org/support. And thanks, everybody, very much. See ya.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
Hey, Al Scott here for Rye Guys T-shirts. Rye Guys, that's WRYGuys.com. Great, irreverent, thought-provoking T-shirts upholding a pro-freedom perspective. Inspired by such classic humorists as Mark Twain, H.L. Mencken, and Oscar Wilde, they invoke the wit and wisdom of the past to satirize modern myths. These high-quality shirts for men and women look good and feel good, and they make great gifts. Use the coupon code SCOTT for 15% off. Rye Guys T-shirts at ryguys.com. That's WRYGuys.com.